you are listening in to Mediapolis Now, the podcast channel of Mediapolis, a journal of cities and culture. This is our Voices podcast series, in which we interview thinkers and practitioners about their work at the junction of cities, culture, and media. I am your host, Scott Rogers. In this episode, we speak with Monica Dagan and Jillian Rose. Monica Dagan is professor of urban cultural sociology at Brunel University of London in the UK. Her research focuses on the practices and politics of experiential urbanism. Largely through ethnographic approaches, Monica's work explores how multisensory, temporal, and emotional dimensions not only shape how we live in cities, but also, increasingly, how planners, architects, place branding professionals, and others design them. Jillian Rose is professor of human geography at the University of Oxford. Jillian is well known across the humanities and social sciences for her book, Visual Methods, An Introduction to Researching with Visual Materials, which published its fifth edition in 2022. She identifies first and foremost as a cultural geographer, and her multifaceted work has centered on the techniques and politics of knowledge production about places. Most recently, she has devoted much of her attention to how digital visualizing technologies are shifting urban life and its spatial and temporal organization. Our discussion centered on Monica and Jillian's recent book, The New Urban Aesthetic, Digital Experiences of Urban Change. It is a book that explores the coming together of new digital technologies and urban branding, and specifically how these are increasingly being geared towards new kinds of sensory, bodily experiences in and across different urban sites and scales. Not only do we discuss the central arguments of the book or its fascinating case studies, we also touch on the trajectories of work that brought them to write it in the first place, and where their work is headed next. And you may be pleased to know that a readable version of the interview you are about to hear has been published simultaneously in the Mediapolis Q&A series. In the preface to your book, you mention how in 2017, the two of you realized in a conversation over a coffee that there was a common theme emerging from some of the projects that each of you were working on, individually but also together. And this centered on the ways that digital visualizations are changing how we conceive of and engage with cities. So I'm wondering if we can start with a brief vignette into the trajectories of your research and thinking, which led to you coming together to write this book.
Yeah, so I'll start off. Monica and I met when we were both working at the Open University, I think about 15 years ago now, although it might be
2004, I
longer,
think.
Really, yeah. I was going to say, I think I'm not wanting to think about just how long ago it was. And the first time we collaborated was on a research project, which, interestingly, because I'd forgotten this, it was actually called Urban Aesthetics. And we were interested in how people were experiencing two very different kinds of high streets, both in kind of so-called ordinary towns in sort of middle England, Bedford and Milton Keynes. And I was interested in urban design, how people sort of, in particular, how people saw places. Milton Keynes in particular was built to be quite a, I mean, now it looks like a shopping mall, but at the time it was a very sort of modernist new version of what high street might be. I was interested in how we might develop new methods to grasp those sort of experiences. And Monica was bringing her own set of interests to that shared project.
Yeah, I was more interested in thinking about methods to capture experiences. So I've had a long-standing interest in sensory experiences and how we can actually qualify them, but also research them and finding different methods. So the project was really trying to test different methods to understand how very different social groups experience high streets in very different ways.
So following that work, we hooked up with Claire Melhuish, Professor Claire Melhuish, as she is now, at UCL's Urban Lab. And we started to get interested in how those sort of kind of embodied feelings or views about designed urban environments were being mediated, and in particular, because Claire has quite a strong architectural background, the three of us combining our forces, we decided to put together a research grant application looking at how computer-generated images were shaping the architectural design process. We got the grant, the three of us, and after a slightly hairy period where we turned out that all the architect studios who'd offered us access turned around and said, well, sorry, we've changed our minds, we eventually landed on one case study, which is a large urban redevelopment project in Doha in Qatar, where computer-generated images were absolutely fundamental to how they were trying to integrate the look and the feel of a very large project that had a lot of different architects, quite sort of high-end architects kind of working on it. And so the three of us really worked through that, particularly the role of these computer-generated images. And that was really, I think, the first moment for both of us that we started to think about the digital, which is a bit of an overgeneration, at least about computer-generated images and what a force they were really in terms of urban design. And then subsequently we've gone on to think about how that shapes urban experiencing.
And it made quite clear to us, I think, that digital technologies are crucial in architectural practices to imagine future developments, but also a tool to make it easy for audiences to understand what the future would feel and look like. And I found that particularly interesting to research in more detail. But we then also diverted routes again, and Gillian started to research much more smart cities. And I was involved, well, I did two things in the following years. On the one hand, I got a British Academy fellowship to look at timescapes of urban change, where I had more time to think about how experiences are also underpinned by temporal scales and different temporalities. And at the same time, I was also doing a project, HRC networking project that worked with museums and branding companies and also local authorities to understand how we can actually work together and learn together how to research again the senses in urban environments. And I think it's quite important as an academic to acknowledge that there's a lot to learn from practitioners. And it was really interesting to actually, in this project that was called Sensory Cities, to work across three different cities in Europe, Barcelona, Köln and London, to really understand how city museums are curating the history, but also the contemporary issues of different cities through different curatorial practices, but also methodologies. And for example, in Barcelona, we had one of the branding experts of Barcelona Council sharing a box with us that had a different smells of Barcelona as a branding product. And to really think, you know, how can we, both academics and practitioners, start using each other's methodologies to not only research the sensory, but acknowledge how important it is in urban redevelopment, in tourism, in branding cities.
So all these trajectories, to me, come together in the premise with which you start the book, and I'll quote it. Something is changing in cities. Something about how we feel in urban spaces is altering, end quote. And I guess this something is what you are calling the new urban aesthetic. Now, aesthetic is sometimes associated with the visual, but your conception in the book is rather more complex. So tell me a little bit about the notion of aesthetics that is at play in your argument in this book.
So aesthetics for us is much more than the visual. It is the whole bodily experience, and we're drawing on the original Greek concept of aesthesis, which means perception through the senses. And what we really were trying to do with this concept is to think how it is used and brings together bodies, digital technologies, and urban redevelopment. It has really become a central concept through the notion of the experience economy, for example, in the development of cities across the world. And we argue strongly in the book, and I guess I've argued throughout my career, that experience has become the crucial tool for contemporary cities to catapult themselves as tourist resorts, but also places for investment on, you know, what I call the global catwalk. So what we wanted to do really with this concept is to draw attention on the sensory experiencing of cities and how important the senses are engaging us in our everyday understandings of the city, and that it's the fine-grained sensations, you know, the smelling, the touching, the feeling of cities that slowly build up into this kind of lived urban experience where our body constantly interacts with the materiality of the city, with the infrastructures of the city, and with other bodies. So what we're arguing in the book, and what, again, this concept is trying to do, is that digital devices are increasingly part of this sensory texture of everyday urban life. So if you think about it, bodies hold and carry smartphones with them. Then we have tablets, laptops, gaming devices, ebook readers. We're constantly interacting in our everyday urban life with all these digital tools. And we can basically say that bodies in many city spaces now simultaneously occupy both material urban spaces and the digital on-screen environment simultaneously. And Anna Münster has actually described this as a double digital embodiment. So bodies inhabit a space grafted between the experience of being in online environments and the corporeality, which, you know, they experience in situ in a physical place. And it's really that what we wanted to grasp with our notion of the new urban aesthetic, in that these urban spaces are increasingly sensorially mediated through digital technologies. And thinking about that really shifts the attention from individual bodies towards the extension of sensory feelings in digitally mediated urban environments. And that's really what we meant with a new urban aesthetic, so to speak.
So I could say a little bit more about the digital sort of angle on that, which I think for us is partly about the technological affordances, but also very much about how it's experienced, practiced, imagined, kind of discursive, that's my word, I think, construction of the digital. So through the book, we pay attention to things like sensors, so environmental sensors, but also the fact that everybody's smartphone is also a sensor. And in particular, they, you know, for example, they change a body into a, you know, a blue dot on a screen, or they convert bodies particularly into geolocated data. We talk quite a bit about screens, so both smartphone screens, like Monica commented, but also, you know, large public screens. You know, I mean, there's so many on the tube coming here at the news stations. All have screens embedded against this escalator. It's constantly moving imagery. And in particular, I think that shapes how we interpret urban spaces, how we see them. And then, of course, all of this is networked. Franco, I think, Cassetti, who's a cinema theorist, has this notion of hypertopia, which I think is really interesting. So this idea that you're in this space, but that online environment that Monica was also saying is also really distributed. So I think we think there's something very interesting going on about a way which we can develop a vocabulary to sort of grasp this in a bit more analytical sense, is to focus on how spatial and temporal organizations are shifting along with and through these new range of digital technologies.
Yeah. And I mean, the one thing that comes through really strongly when you read the book is a kind of commitment to thinking about the multiplicity or different forms of new urban aesthetics. And that comes through in many ways, but one of the ways it comes through most kind of obviously, I guess, is that you have these three case studies that you use, each of which connects thematically, but as you put it loosely, with one aspect of Henri Lefebvre's triadic conception of space. So let's begin with the first case study, which focuses on place branding imagery in Doha. What is it about images of Qatar's capital that tell us something about how we see and experience cities today? And in particular, as you see it, the conceived new urban aesthetics of what you call glamour.
Yeah, so that was, I guess, the first major case study that we worked on together, and it prompted a lot of the ideas, at least got us thinking about the larger project of the book. And I think when we started that project, that kind of imagery was a little less familiar than it is now. I mean, now we all know, I think, generally using the we, that's always a bit problematic, but, you know, we see these sorts of computer-generated images. They're very familiar to us. You know, it seems like every single housing, urban development, large or small. I think what was distinctive, though, about this Doha project in particular was that it was a very large project. It was very high prestige, and so there was a lot of money available for these, what are actually very demanding images to create even now. There's a lot of skill that goes into them. And the architectural language advisor, which was the role, the person who was in charge of the creation of these images and making them work as kind of design tools, was very clear that he wanted them to evoke the feel of the place. So they were built from the actual architectural models that the architects are working with. So they were also realistic. I'm doing the inverted commas here with it. But they were also very much intended to be kind of glamorous, alluring. They had a very particular colour palette. And there's quite a literature on the idea of glamour. And we really felt that the idea that glamour is kind of magical, elegant, it has to be effortless, it has to be a little mysterious, it has to kind of draw you in somehow. You know, this was very much what those CGIs were trying to do. So in a sense, they were just a branding exercise. But, and I think this comes back to Monica's early comment about, you know, how you learn stuff when you talk to people who are actually making these kind of things. We also realised that there was a very strong desire among the developers who were Qatari-based that these images should look distinctive. And that was a lot to do with the colour palette, with the lights, with the particular shadows, with a slight dusty feeling in the air. Distinctive in the sense that they didn't want it to look like just another, you know, one of these kind of repeated urban formations. There was a kind of distinctiveness that they wanted as well. So I think now, although we are quite sceptical about these branding images, it was a good example to start with about the ways in which the digitality of these images allowed them to be worked across by lots of different stakeholders and really emerge as a very powerful visual image that shaped how the project was developed.
And just to add, I think we were very keen to show, like you mentioned at the start, the different urban aesthetic. You know, there are many of them, they're differentiated, they're multiple, and they express themselves very differently in different localities. So we chose three very different case studies. So like Gillian just said, Qatar was this grand regeneration. Milton Keynes, the next case study, was much more a retrofitting kind of urban regeneration. And our third study was a cultural regeneration in London. And we deliberately chose different scales of cities, but also try to really think about how regeneration is not this uniform kind of template, but is expressed very differently and operates very differently in different localities. So there are many different aesthetics, and these are mediated through different digital technologies differently again. And it really helped us to think about these different constellations that happen with the new urban aesthetic. And there are many more that we hope other scholars will identify and research in much more detail. And what we also then tried to do is, you mentioned Lefebvre, is to expand Lefebvre's triad of the conceived, perceived, and lived with Janssen's notion of texture. And what he really does is that he describes mediatized spaces as textured spaces. And that refers really to this kind of what, and I'm quoting him here directly, it refers to the communicative weave of fabric that is created through human activities in space. And that these different mediations of place are therefore not just visual, but they have a real effect on how people interact, feel, practice urban environments. And we try to disentangle that in each case study in more detail.
Right. Maybe we can come to the book's second case study then, which you've already mentioned, Monica. You explore in the second case study a place that's rather different to Doha, at least, you know, on the surface, which is Milton Keynes, a place I know as well from my time at the Open University, which is this sort of ambitious 1960s English new town. And, you know, for someone who comes from a planning background, for me, I know well that it was, you know, originally built to service sort of housing shortages in London. But in more recent years, it has become this venue of various kinds of smart city projects. So one of the things you're arguing about Milton Keynes in the book, I think, is that it particularly illustrates a perceived urban aesthetic or urban space of what you call flow. So how is that the case in Milton Keynes?
Yeah, so Milton Keynes is really interesting city, I think. I'm assuming that that's what you're implying when describing it as your planning background. And it has always tried to innovate in terms of urban technologies from its beginnings as a new town in, you know, designed in the late 60s, built through the 70s, they'd continue to expand. And so what the council have been doing there is trying to basically bring in as many sort of smart city technologies and experiments, innovations and projects as they can kind of, you know, persuade to arrive in the city to kind of allow it to become a sort of test bed for a whole range of different kind of smart urbanisms. So there, on one hand, there's a lot of diversity in those projects. But when the team of researchers at the OU I was working with, when we explored a whole range of them, one of the things that certainly struck me with this interest in how human life, human embodiment was being sort of potentially being reconfigured through these various projects was that there was a massive emphasis on mobility, partly in a very obvious sense of sort of transport. So one of the very earliest sort of innovations that took place in the city was a kind of Google Maps before Google Maps. So they tried to sort of integrate all the different transport possibilities into a single interface that you could then use to navigate your way around the city. Milton Keynes has a very poor public transport system, so unfortunately, that was rather overtaken by Google Maps. But I think it does also speak to a sense of, in a lot of the projects we found, there was a whole sense of kind of making urban life better. A lot of them were not run by big corporations. They're often run by the council or the council working with different kinds of community groups. But even then, there was a sense of sort of mobility for health, getting out into the city, enabling people to cycle better, and then a whole load of commercial apps around kind of delivery, bookings. You know, there was a very strong emphasis on engaging with the city through using different kinds, specifically of smartphone app, particularly around being able to sort of move and access the city. So another example that struck me was a local midwife collaborated on a kind of innovation project to make the city centre more amenable to people who wanted to breastfeed. So you downloaded the app. If you felt comfortable breastfeeding a place, you'd give it 5 stars on the, you know, then. So it was all about opening out the city, which is kind of radical in some ways, I think, although, you know, how it's commercialized, of course, in other contexts can be very different. But a lot of it was about this kind of sense of kinesthetic flow, I suppose, of physical embodiment. And I think that's why we described it as perceived, because it's a very sort of material, you know, with your tech, with your body, you're entering physically the city.
Yeah, so one of the ways that sometimes perceived space is, the other way it's described is like practiced space sometimes, or I've heard that term anyways used in relation to that concept from Lefebvre. But I was just wondering, is there something about Milton Keynes that leads to a particular kinds of configurations of practice with technology, or makes it a particular venue for certain types of experiments? It is, I mean, maybe some of the listeners haven't been there. I mean, it might help to let them know a bit about what it's like actually, because I think it's compared often to American cities, but I don't think that's a very good comparison. So, I mean, it's very distinct and unique in some ways.
Yeah, so that's a fair point. And again, comes back to this sense that we called it the new urban aesthetic. And on reflection, perhaps we should have pluralized that, because we emphasize very much in the book, it works in different places in different ways. Milton Keynes is built on a grid system, which makes it very unique, actually, in the UK. And in that sense, I think that's the only sense in which it looks a bit like American cities. So the grids are dual carriageway kind of highways. And in each grid block, there is a kind of well-designed, generally, kind of a neighborhood with local facilities and so on. It's also overlaid with a set of cycle paths, so exclusively meant for cyclists. But when it was designed, it wasn't intended to be accessible in the sense of sort of physically accessible. So all the curbs have kind of like drops into the road and so on. And that makes it, for example, a good environment to test driverless cars, which has been a really good, a big project there as well. It also enabled quite a lot of apps to really maximise that kind of focus on transport in the city. So, for example, the cycle paths are great, but they're not on a grid and they're actually very disorienting, and they also get covered in leaves. And yeah. So one of the apps that was designed was with the local cycling enthusiasts to report, you know, where the cycle paths needed to be cleared of leaves from the council and so on. So it is true that the physical environment of Milton Keynes does enable, to an extent, this kind of emphasis on mobility. But I would say that looking more broadly at how the digital is affecting urban life, and Scott McQuire writes about this, you know, quite eloquently, in generally it's about speed and immediacy and convenience, all through this sense that you're constantly online, you're constantly connected, you're constantly able to message and text. So I think although Milton Keynes has a particular expression of that in terms of its kind of embodied mobility, I think more generally that temporality, there's a speeding up of life in the digitally mediated city for sure.
So in the final case study, we're taken to Smithfield Market, which is a heritage building at the heart of what the City of London Corporation has branded as its Culture Mile. And here your attention not only turns to lived urban spaces, as in the Lefebvrean concept of lived urban spaces, which you also describe in the book as dramatic, but also to the mediations afforded by social media platforms, and in particular, Instagram. So what kinds of new urban aesthetics might we see through the coming together of this particular location and that particular social platform?
I should start by saying that the Culture Mile has been wrapped up in March this year. which is quite interesting, though it's being dismantled very rapidly. And it's actually been turned into a BID, a business improvement district, which has been launched in May this year. In April this year. At the same time, the Corporation of London also created what it calls Destination City, a new tourist strategy to bring people back into the City of London post-COVID and post-Brexit. So just that a bit as a background, things are moving very fast. And just now thinking about temporality, it's quite interesting how, you know, urban redevelopment is speeding up overall across the world. I think what sometimes took 5-10 years, but now it's done in a year or less. A marketing expert mentioned to me that, you know, when gentrification might have taken a decade before, it's now done in a year because there's a template for it.
Right.
What is interesting about this new destination city launched in May 2022 by the City of London is that it's really focusing on the cultural consumption of this area. So it's focusing on events, activities, and placemaking very much through these so-called meanwhile spaces. So what I'm trying to show here is that it's the experience economy at its best. And it comes back to our argument that when we look at urban developments nowadays across the globe, we need to really think about how they are engaged in and enveloped with digital technologies and the experience economy. And that's something we try to analyze in much more detail than with the case study of the Culture Mile in Smithfield Market. So what we argued there, or what we actually showed there, is that social media, with its search for this constant affective intensity that we have when we scroll, etc., is really dramatizing how urban environments are conceived, marketed, and branded, but also how they are increasingly being planned. So what we discovered through the Culture Mile case study was that what's happening in Smithfield Market is, although the urban regeneration wasn't happening yet, the ground was prepared through all kind of social media activities that would, of course, reflect the events and the place, so-called place activation of the locality. But it was really a preparing of the ground of what is going to come now soon. The move of the Museum of London into this former a meat market, etc., etc. So what we try to capture with the notion of drama is that what the affordances of social media provide is that ordinary people can become the directors, let's say, of a photo montage of a show and create these really dramatic images of the area, but not just of its architecture or its people, but also through close-ups of certain materialities or details, like, for example, meat or the phone boxes in Smithfield Market, which really create this kind of staged experience. And what we're arguing in the book is that people then also visit these spaces because they encounter them in social media. So something I mean, it probably is common sense, but we found really interesting is that the branding of spaces is now done both by people, ordinary citizens, and the branding companies, and they work hand in hand. The Culture Mile marketing experts knew and chose specific events and public art projects that they knew would be captured on Instagram or other social media. So I guess what we're arguing is increasingly that urban planning is conceived with social media in mind and as a dramatized urban landscape.
I was going to actually ask about that. I mean, you've already partly answered the question I was going to ask, but is an anticipation of the production of imagery through social media become one of the, you know, kind of key components of place branding now, that when you're branding a place, one of the things that's being anticipated is staging the possibility for a continuing echo of, maybe echo is not the right word, but a continuing production of imagery about that place. As you know, I'm really interested in King's Cross in London. And that does seem to be clearly something that's going on with the King's Cross partnership, that there's a kind of an effort to not just anticipate social media, but even almost stage the physical spaces in such a way that they are amenable to especially Instagram type of imagery of food and of posing in front of particular buildings and that kind of thing. I mean, is this something that is being taught in place branding or something that's kind of part of the discourse of place branding? Maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I was wondering.
I don't know the answer in terms of whether it's being taught. I haven't attended a branding course for quite a while. Actually, maybe I should do that very soon again. I did study marketing and branding at Lancaster, actually, was one of my minor subjects. And that's why I'm really fascinated by it, because I think what's been happening through the experience economy or aesthetic economy, a term that's also often used, is that branding takes over the physicality and the production of places. And, you know, a classic book is The No Logo by Naomi Klein, where she argues this about ordinary products from sneakers to handbags, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, definitely. I do find it shocking, actually, that branding on social media has become now a key factor in designing new urban spaces, definitely. And we don't only see this in the global north, but I've been recently to Bali, and I'm speaking here without having done any deep research on it. But I was quite shocked how in a developing country, in the area where we were in Pererenean, you can see that the local houses, etc., quite simple housing, etc., next to hipster cafes that have been built in the last 2 years, if not in the last 12 months, which all have a very similar aesthetic. And when you enter them, a lot of digital nomads are sitting with their Apple Macs there, and you could be anywhere in the world. And when you go outside, you know, you are in Bali, where the streets are still being constructed, so to speak. And yeah, it's a complete kind of paradox, I feel. I don't think this is designed on purpose, of course, in Bali, but I think increasingly cities and urban planners, urban designers have very much in mind, how will this be branded through social media?
So towards the end of the book, you both turn your attention to the politics of aesthetics. And for this, you draw on Jacques Rancière's work, which is under the same heading, on the politics of aesthetics, and particularly his notion of the distribution of the sensible. So I'm wondering how this notion of the distribution of the sensible helps you conclude your book by turning to a discussion around the relationships of the new urban aesthetic and power.
I mean, the aim of the book really is to try and find a conceptual vocabulary, try and develop a conceptual vocabulary through which these different manifestations of the new urban aesthetic, you know, we've been talking through lots of different examples of them, how we can sort of describe them and think about their consequences, which I guess is their power relations that they enact, that they create. And for me, I think that, you know, the body, if there is such a thing, is a really powerful site for thinking. You know, it's one form of power. It's certainly not the only form of power, I think, that's been enacted by, for example, you know, platforms and so on in the city. There's so much other really important research, you know, examining the kind of political economy of that and so on. But I think this kind of sensory aspect is also really critical. And Rancière gives you, yeah, I think we use him fairly lightly, but this notion of the distribution of the sensible, I think, is a useful way of focusing in on the embodied, fleshy consequences of the kind of things that we've been discussing. The phrase "the distribution," you know, begins to talk to the kind of spatiality and temporality of how particular embodied experiences are felt. And I think because bodies themselves are always already sites of kind of power, they're gendered, they're racialized, they're abled in different ways, sexualized, and so on and so forth, how certain bodies' dispositions kind of line up or don't with particular distributions of the sensible is a really useful perspective in trying to get to grips with this particular kind of power dynamic. So I think looking back on the book, I guess it's implicit in the conversation that we've been having. The framework that we developed, so Lefebvre, Rancière, was a bit of a kind of post hoc framework. The projects emerged, we developed them, and then we were like, well, how, you know, there's something going on here, you know, how can we try and bring it together? And I think if we'd started off with a framework, we probably would have conducted some of those case studies differently. And I think we would have probably maybe used some different methods to look much more closely at exactly how people felt, you know, when they were doing these things. We kind of read that a little bit from the case studies, if I'm being honest. But there's certainly lots of other work, particularly around social media and the urban, which is beginning to address these issues, or at least that we can sort of flex and adapt to our framework. So one of them, of the many I could have chosen, is a project by John Boy and Jos Uytema. I think they have something like 4.5 million tweets scraped from Instagram that they've located in Amsterdam. And of course, locating, it's Insta posts, isn't it? You know, how you geolocate social media posts, it's a complicated thing. So they've got a lot of very technical expertise underpinning this project. But they also make it very, very clear how, through all sorts of different kinds of both large-scale computational methods for researching this, but also qualitative, sort of interview-based, that different forms of different visual posts line up with different kind of social groupings. And in fact, they're particularly interested in different kinds of gentrifying groups within the city and the kinds of things that get pictured. This is what Monica was picking out in Smithfield as well, you know, how things get pictured, what gets pictured, you know, particular locations, particular kind of activities, particular sorts of objects are pictured in particular kind of ways. As they are pictured and shared across particular social networks, then certain kinds of gentrifying identities emerge. And I think that's quite a powerful way of figuring out, you know, just this sort of embodied sense of gentrification. These are very much white, obviously, your middle class gentrifiers. I think a lot of white women are doing this kind of, you know, particularly kind of certain kinds of, you know, sort of well-being gentrification sort of intersection. And it's a paper recently that they came out from their project talking about the ways that a lot of the immigrant small businesses in many of these areas are now having to reshape, or they're being advised to kind of represent themselves in ways that are going to be Instagrammable and appeal to these gentrifiers' interest in kind of the exotic quotes. And so I think that's a really good example of the ways in which these apparently very sort of, you know, soft and fluffy feelingy, you know, I like my coffee in a particular way, I like to eat this, I like to dance here, actually turn into really very material politics in the city.
We deliberately wanted to also focus on power relations to challenge a bit this view that the sensory is just this fluffy kind of topic. And what we really wanted to show here is that aesthetics and that the sensory itself is political. And it's been a lifetime attempt in my work to really show that, you know, it's key to understand who and what is included and excluded in the mediation and framing of experience. And it has, like Gillian said, real material consequences that, you know, are very much framed within very important power relations. I also wanted to add that we deliberately used the word aesthetics because we drew very much on Böhmer's work on the aesthetic economy, which really points out about the production of experiences. That, yes, on the one hand, we experience places, but increasingly places are staged and produced to create particular experiences, which then, you know, means that other experiences don't have the space to be there, although there are all kind of things going on and they might be challenged or disrupted, et cetera, et cetera. But we also use the word aesthetics because, you know, when you think about aesthetics in non-academic ways, people relate the word aesthetics to lifestyle issues. And we really wanted to highlight that as well in relation to the aesthetic economy. And, you know, other people have written in terms of aesthetics in relation to Bourdieu and the analysis of taste and differentiation of class taste through aesthetics. So it's a very deliberate use of aesthetics that we wanted to bring to the fore in this book. And we wanted to really highlight that focusing on the sensory allows us to link structural changes, economic changes, political changes with everyday life activities, practices, and experiences. And for me, there is a real political motivation in showing that politics is about experiences, it's about emotions, it's about what a lot of people in the past have called fluffy things. And they're not fluffy at all because, as I think social media is showing us, they have a real impact on people's lives. And the really point of the book is to show how our cities are now physically being transformed because of all the digital technologies and changes in the digital world that are happening. So they will have a real impact, of course, on how we live, but also how we encounter each other.
Mm. So we started the conversation talking about the trajectories that led you to this book. And it makes sense, I think, for me to then ask you, what are the trajectories that are now flowing from the book for each of you individually and collectively?
So I'm actually, I guess, bedding more into my comfort zone, I suppose, which is to think through kind of forms of sort of cultural critique. You know, I started as a cultural geographer, and I'm really interested in the ways in which visuals, especially digital visualizations, digital software, creating all sorts of imagery of cities, is beginning to, I would argue, reconfigure human life in the urban. I'm calling the project Animated Urbanism. And what the project is trying to do is looking through a series of case studies, but kind of reading different kinds of digital visual productions, and in particular, the ways that they're kind of hybridizing across different fields of practice. So I've got a bunch of case studies of kind of urban planning and management techniques that are digital visuals, city digital twins, agent-based modeling. Even tried reading some AI, but that's that's a step too far at the moment. But also then looking at disaster movies, looking at digital visual effects in movies more generally, looking at city building games. I've actually just downloaded a computer game for the first time. This is new territory.
What game? Is it City Skylines?
It is. Okay. Yeah, so not original, but I'm not going to turn into a gamer overnight. So I will go for a game widely known, thank you, Scott, but also used to teach planners how to plan. And actually, it's got a very specific visualization of what urban life is like, which is very similar to City Digital Twins and to movie VFX. They're all computer graphics. They're all three-dimensional volumetric regimes, as it's been called, through which human life in cities is being pictured in very, very particular ways. So, yeah, that's my project. I'm having a lot of fun looking at things like generic disaster movies and trying to become a gamer. But also, I think, again, it's kind of fun, it's kind of fluffy, but actually it's really got a very consistent sense of how life, human life in particular, is configured as mobile crowds, individual objects and so on. I'm trying to think that through across these different fields.
Yeah, and I've been looking more at branding campaigns in the last year, back to where I started a lot of my work. I did during my master, I looked at the Barcelona Olympics and how the city had been catapulted to the global catwalk through new branding, and from being a grey city became this tourist haven nowadays. Yeah, so I'm back there, back in Barcelona, looking at the latest branding campaigns, especially in the last since COVID. And it's just really interesting, again, how the city doesn't feature its tourist attractions anymore, but it is the life on the streets in Barcelona, and really is trying to sell being part of what I've called the civic experience of being in the city. Yeah, so I've been writing on that. Also, what we've been thinking about, both of us, in more detail, is that basically digital visualizations are really extending their form and reach much more into urban spaces in new ways. And these immersive environments, or even immersive cities like NEOM, emerging across the globe. And I think there's a lot of potential for new research to find out what next.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that interview with Monica Dagan and Jillian Rose, discussing the implications of the new urban aesthetic for cities today and into the future. Stay tuned for our next episode, and in the meantime, do take a look at the Mediapolis Journal website by visiting MediapolisJournal, that's all one word, .com. That's MediapolisJournal.com, where you can find thought-provoking content such as Cortland Rankin's special dossier on mediating urban mobility, which explores how media affects how we reflect, interpret, and shape the relationship between automobility and urbanism. After reading Rankin's thoughtful introduction, you can delve into 10 articles exploring topics such as how we might see post-war American automobility through the lens of film noir and neo-noir, the more localized automotive cultures in cities like New York City, Stockholm, Gothenburg, and Birmingham, UK, the relationships between automobility and social mobility, and new aesthetic and technological approaches to recalibrating our perceptions of automobility. I'm Scott Rogers, and you have been listening to Mediapolis Now.